rules for corpus delicti. I've got a little list. They never will be missed. Mike, how close do you have to be?
Beg pardon?
If you had been in the hallway and I'd been back by the window, 30 feet, could you have stopped it from hitting me? Smith appeared mildly surprised.
Yes.
Come to the window. Suppose Jill and I were on the far side of the pool and you were here. Could you have stopped the box?
Yes, Jubal.
Well, suppose Jill and I were down at the gate a quarter of a mile away. Is that too far?
Smith hesitated. Jubal, it is not distance. It is not seeing. It is knowing.
Let's see if I grok it. It doesn't matter how far. You don't even have to see it. If you know that a bad thing is happening, you can stop it. Right?
Smith looked troubled. Almost is right. But I am not long out of the nest, for knowing I must see. An old one does not need eyes to know. He knows, he groks, he acts. I am sorry.
I don't know why you're sorry, Jubal said gruffly. The High Minister for Peace would have declared you top secret 10 minutes ago.
Beg pardon?
Never mind.
Jubal returned to his desk, picked up a heavy ashtray.
Jill, don't aim at my face. Okay, Mike. Stand in the hallway.
Jubal, my brother. Please, not.
What's the trouble? I want one more demonstration, and this time I won't take my eyes off it.
Jubal.
Yes, Jill.
I grok what is bothering Mike.
Well, tell me.
We did an experiment where I was about to hurt you with that box. But we are his water brothers, so it upset Mike that I even tried. I think there is something very un-Martian about such a situation.
Harshaw frowned. Maybe it should be investigated by the Committee on Un-Martian Activities.
I'm not joking, Jubal.
Nor I. All right, Jill, I'll re-rig it.
Harshaw handed the ashtray to Mike.
Feel how heavy it is, son? See those sharp corners?
Smith examined it gingerly. Harshaw went on.
I'm going to throw it up and let it hit me in the head as it comes down.
Mike stared. My brother, you will now discorporate?
Eh? No, no. But it will hurt me unless you stop it. Here we go.
Harshaw tossed it straight up within inches of the high ceiling. The ashtray topped its trajectory. Stopped. Harshaw looked at it, feeling stuck in one frame of a motion picture. He croaked,
Anne, what do you see?
She answered in a flat voice. That ashtray is 5 inches from the ceiling. I do not see anything holding it up. She added, Jubal, I think that's what I'm seeing, but if my cameras don't show the same thing, I'm going to tear up my license.
Jill.
It floats. Jubal went to his desk and sat down without taking his eyes off the ashtray.
Mike, he said, why didn't it disappear?
But Jubal, Mike said apologetically, you said to stop it. You did not say to make it go away. When I made the box go away, you wanted it to be again. Have I done wrongly?
Oh, no, you have done exactly right. I keep forgetting that you take things literally.
Harshaw recalled insults common in his early years, and reminded himself never to use such to Mike. If he told the boy to drop dead or get lost, Harshaw felt certain that the literal meaning would ensue. I am glad, Smith answered soberly. I am sorry I could not make the box be again. I am sorry twice that I wasted food, then a necessity was. Or so I grokked.
Eh? What food?
Jill said hastily. He's talking about those men, Jubal. Berquist and the man with him.
Oh, yes.
Harshaw reflected that he retained un-Martian notions of food.
Mike, don't worry about wasting that food. I doubt if a meat inspector would have passed them. In fact, he added, recalling the Federation convention about long pig, they would have been condemned as unfit to eat. Besides, it was a necessity. You grokked the fullness and acted rightly.
I am much comforted, Mike answered with relief in his voice. Only an old one can always be sure of right action at a cusp, and I have much learning to learn and growing to grow before I may join the old ones. Jubal, may I move it? I am tiring.
You want to make it go away? Go ahead.
But I cannot.
Eh? Why not?
Your head is no longer under it. I do not grok wrongness in its being where it is.
Oh. All right, move it.
Harshaw continued to watch, expecting it to float to the spot now over his head, and thus regain a wrongness. Instead, the ashtray slanted downward until it was close above his desk, hovered, then came into a landing.
Thank you, Jubal, said Smith.
Thank you, son.
Jubal picked up the ashtray. It was as commonplace as ever.
Yes, thank you. For the most amazing experience I've had since the hired girl took me up into the attic.
He looked up.
And you trained it, Ryan?
Yes.
Have you seen levitation before?
She hesitated. I've seen what was called telekinesis with dice, but I'm no mathematician and cannot testify that it was telekinesis.
Hell's bells, you wouldn't testify that the sun had risen if the day was cloudy.
How could I? Somebody might be supplying artificial light above the cloud layer. One of my classmates could apparently levitate objects about the mass of a paperclip, but he had to be 3 drinks drunk. I was not able to examine it closely enough to testify, because I'd been drinking too.
You've never seen anything like this?
No.
I'm through with you professionally. If you want to stay, hang up your robe and drag up a chair.
Thanks, I will. But in view of your lecture about mosques and synagogues, I'll change in my room.
Suit yourself. Wake up Duke and tell him I want the cameras serviced.
Yes, boss. Don't let anything happen until I get back.
Anne headed for the door. No promises. Mike, sit at my desk. Now, can you pick up that ashtray? Show me.
Yes, Jubal.
Smith reached out and took it in his hand.
No, no.
I did wrongly?
No, it was my mistake. I want to know if you can lift it without touching it.
Yes, Jubal.
Well, are you tired?
No, Jubal.
Then what's the matter? Does it have to have a wrongness?
No, Jubal.
Jubal, Jill interrupted. You haven't told him to. You just asked if he could.
Oh.
Jubal looked sheepish.
Mike, will you please, without touching it, lift that ashtray a foot above the desk?
Yes, Jubal.
The ashtray raised, floated above the desk.
Will you measure, Jubal?
Mike said anxiously.
If I did wrongly, I will move it.
That's fine. Can you hold it? If you get tired, tell me.
I will tell.
Can you lift something else too, say this pencil? If you can do it, do it.
Yes, Jubal.
The pencil ranged itself by the ashtray. By request, Mike added other articles to the floating objects. Anne returned, pulled up a chair, and silently watched. Duke came in carrying a stepladder, glanced, looked a second time, said nothing, and set up the ladder. At last, Mike said uncertainly,
I am not sure, Jubal.
He seemed to search for a word.
I am idiot in these things.
Don't wear yourself out.
I can think one more. I hope.
A paperweight stirred, lifted, and the dozen odd floating objects all fell down. Mike seemed about to weep.
Jubal, I am utmostly sorry.
Harshaw patted his shoulder.
You should be proud, son. What you just did is...
Jubal searched for a comparison within Mike's experience.
What you did is harder than tying shoestrings, more wonderful than doing a 1.5 gainer perfectly. You did it, brightly, brightly, and with beauty. You grok?
Mike looked surprised.
I should not feel shame.
You should feel proud.
Yes, Jubal,
he answered contentedly.
I feel proud.
Good. Mike, I cannot lift even one ashtray without touching it.
Smith looked startled.
You cannot?
No. Can you teach me?
Yes, Jubal. You...
Smith stopped, looked embarrassed.
I again have not words. I will read and read and read until I find words. Then I will teach my brother.
Don't set your heart on it.
Beg pardon?
Mike, don't be disappointed if you do not find the words. They may not be in the English language.
Smith considered this.
Then I will teach my brother the language of my nest.
You may have arrived 50 years late.
I have acted wrongly?
Not at all. You might start by teaching Jill your language.
It hurts my throat,
objected Jill.
Try gargling aspirin.
Jubal looked at her. That's a feeble excuse, nurse.
You're hired as research assistant for Martian linguistics, which includes extra duties as may be necessary. Anne, put her on the payroll and be sure it gets in the tax records.
She's been doing her share in the kitchen. Shall I date it back?
Jubal shrugged. Don't bother me with details.
But Jubal, Jill protested, I don't think I can learn Martian.
You can try.
But
what was that about gratitude? Do you take the job?
Jill bit her lip.
I'll take it. Yes, boss.
Smith timidly touched her hand.
Jill, I will teach.
Jill patted his.
Thanks, Mike.
She looked at Harshaw.
I'm going to learn it just to spite you.
He grinned at her.
That motive I grok. You'll learn it. Mike, what else can you do that we can't?
Smith looked puzzled.
I do not know.
How could he, protested Jill, when he doesn't know what we can and can't do?
Yes. And change that title to Assistant for Martian Linguistics, Culture, and Techniques. Jill, in learning their language, you are bound to stumble onto things that are different, really different, and when you do, tell me. And Mike, if you notice anything which you can do but we don't, tell me.
I will tell Jubal. What things will be these?
I don't know, things like you just did. And being able to stay on the bottom of the pool longer than we can. Duke.
Boss, I've got both hands full of film.
You can talk, can't you?
I notice the pool is murky. I'm going to add precipitin tonight and vacuum it in the morning.
How's the count?
It's okay, the water is safe enough to serve at the table, it just looks messy.
Let it be. I'll let you know when I want it cleaned.
Hell, boss, nobody likes to swim in dishwater.
Anybody too fussy can stay dry. Quit jawing, Duke. Film's ready?
5 minutes.
Good. Mike, do you know what a gun is?
A gun, Smith answered carefully, is a piece of ordnance for throwing projectiles by force of some explosive as gunpowder, consisting of a tube or barrel closed at one end, where the...
Okay. Do you grok it?
I am not sure.
Have you ever seen a gun?
I do not know.
Why, certainly you have, Jill interrupted. Mike, think back to that time we talked about in the room with the grass floor, but don't get upset. One man hit me.
Yes.
The other pointed something at me.
He pointed a bad thing at you.
That was a gun.
I had think that the word for that bad thing might be gun. Webster's New International Dictionary of the English Language, 3rd edition, published in...
That's fine, son,
Harshaw said hastily.
Now listen. If someone points a gun at Jill, what will you do?
Smith paused longer than usual.
You will not be angry if I waste food?
No. Under those circumstances, no one would be angry at you. But I want to know something else. Could you make the gun go away without making the man go away?
Smith considered it.
Save the food.
That isn't what I mean. Could you cause the gun to go away without hurting the man?
Jubal, he would not hurt. I would make the gun go away. The man, I would just stop. He would feel no pain. He would simply discorporate. The food would not damage.
Harshaw sighed.
Yes, I'm sure that's the way it would be. But could you cause to go away just the gun, not stop the man, not kill him, just let him go on living?
Smith considered it.
That would be easier than doing both at once. But, Jubal, if I left him corporate, he might still hurt Jill. Or so I grok it.
Harshaw stopped to remind himself that this baby innocent was neither babyish nor innocent, was in fact sophisticated in a culture which he was beginning to realize was far in advance of human culture in mysterious ways, and that these naive remarks came from a superman, or what would do for a superman. He answered Smith, choosing words carefully, as he had in mind a dangerous experiment.
Mike, if you reach a cusp, where you must do something to protect Jill. You do it.
Yes, Jubal, I will.
Don't worry about wasting food. Don't worry about anything else. Protect Jill.
Always I will protect Jill.
Good. But suppose a man pointed a gun, or simply had it in his hand. Suppose you did not want to kill him, but needed to make the gun go away. Could you do it?
Mike paused briefly.
I think I grok it. A gun is a wrong thing, but it might be needful for the man to remain corporate.
He thought.
I can do it.
Good, Mike. I'm going to show you a gun. A gun is a wrong thing.
A gun is a wrong thing. I will make it go away.
Don't make it go away as soon as you see it.
Not?
Not. I will lift the gun and start to point it at you. Before I can get it pointed at you, make it go away. But don't stop me. Don't hurt me. Don't kill me. Don't do anything to me. Don't waste me as food, either.
Oh, I never would, Mike said earnestly. When you discorporate my brother Jubal, I hope to be allowed to eat of you myself, praising and cherishing you with every bite until I grok you in fullness.
Harshaw controlled a reflex and answered gravely,
Thank you, Mike.
It is I who must thank you, my brother. And if it should be that I am selected before you, I hope that you will find me worthy of grokking, sharing me with Jill. You would share me with Jill? Please?
Harshaw glanced at Jill, saw that she kept her face serene, reflected that she was probably a rock-steady scrubbed nurse.
I will share you with Jill,
he said solemnly.
But, Mike, none of us will be food anytime soon. I'm going to show you this gun, and you wait until I say. And then be very careful, because I have many things to do before I'm ready to discorporate.
I will be careful, my brother.
All right.
Harshaw opened a drawer.
Look in here, Mike. See the gun? I'm going to pick it up. But don't do anything until I tell you.
Harshaw reached for the gun, an elderly police special, took it out.
Get ready. Mike. Now.
Harshaw did his best to aim the weapon at Smith. His hand was empty. Jubal found that he was shaking, so he stopped.
Perfect, he said. You got it before I had it aimed.
I am happy.
So am I. Duke, did that get in the camera?
Yep.
Good.
Harshaw sighed.
That's all, kids. Run along.
Anne said, Boss, you'll tell me what the films show?
Want to stay and see them?
Oh, no, I couldn't. Not the parts I witnessed. But I want to know later whether or not they show that I've slipped my clutches.
Okay.
Chapter 13 When they had gone, Harshaw started to give orders to Duke, then said grumpily,
What are you looking sour about?
Boss, when do we get rid of that ghoul?
Ghoul? Why, you provincial lout.
Okay, so I'm from Kansas. Never was any cannibalism in Kansas. I'm eating in the kitchen until he leaves.
Harshaw said icily.
So? Anne can have your check ready in 5 minutes. It ought not to take more than 10 to pack your comic books and your other shirt.
Duke had been setting up a projector. He stopped.
I didn't mean I was quitting.
It means that to me, son.
But what the hell? I've eaten in the kitchen lots of times.
Other circumstances. Nobody under my roof refuses to eat at my table because he won't eat with others who eat there. I am an almost extinct breed, an old-fashioned gentleman, which means I can be a cast-iron son of a bitch when it suits me. It suits me right now, which is to say that no ignorant, superstitious, prejudiced bumpkin is permitted to tell me who is fit to eat at my table. I dine with publicans and sinners. That is my business. I do not break bread with Pharisees.
Duke said slowly,
I ought to pop you one. And I would if you were my age.
Don't let that stop you. I may be tougher than you think. If not, the commotion will fetch the others. Do you think you can handle the man from Mars?
Him? I could break him in two with one hand.
Probably. If you could lay a hand on him.
Huh?
You saw me try to point a pistol at him.
Duke,
where's that pistol? Find that pistol, then tell me whether you still think you can break Mike in two. But find the pistol first.
Duke went ahead setting up the projector. Some sleight of hand. The films will show it,
Harshaw said. Duke,
Stop fiddling with that. Sit down. I'll take care of it after you've left.
Huh? Jubal, I don't want you touching this projector. You always get it out of whack.
Sit down, I said.
But,
Duke, I'll bust the damn thing if it suits me. I do not accept service from a man after he has resigned.
Hell, I didn't resign. You got nasty and fired me. For no reason.
Sit down, Duke, Harshaw said quietly. And let me try to save your life. Or get off this place as fast as you can. Don't stop to pack. You might not live that long.
What the hell do you mean?
Exactly what I say. Duke, it's irrelevant whether you resigned or were fired. You ended your employment when you announced that you would not eat at my table. Nevertheless, I would find it distasteful for you to be killed on my premises. So sit down and I will do my best to avoid it.
Duke looked startled and sat down. Harshaw went on.
Are you Mike's water brother?
Huh? Of course not. Oh, I've heard such chatter. It's nonsense if you ask me.
It is not nonsense, and nobody asked you. You aren't competent to have an opinion.
Harshaw frowned.
Duke, I don't want to fire you. You keep the gadgetry working and save me from annoyance by mechanical buffoonery, but I must get you safely off the place, and then find out who else is not a water brother to Mike, and see that they become such, or send them away too.
Jubal chewed his lip.
Maybe it would be enough to extract a promise from Mike not to hurt anyone without my permission. No, too much horseplay around here. And Mike is prone to misinterpret things. Say if you, or Larry, since you won't be here, picked up Jill and tossed her into the pool. Larry might wind up where that pistol went before I could explain to Mike that Jill was not in danger. Larry is entitled to live his life without having it cut short through my carelessness. Duke, I believe in everyone's working out his own damnation, but that is no excuse to give a dynamite cap to a baby.
Duke said slowly,
Boss, you've come unzipped.
Mike wouldn't hurt anybody. Shucks, his cannibalism talk makes me want to throw up, but don't get me wrong. He's a savage, he doesn't know any better, but he's gentle as a lamb. He would never hurt anybody.
You think so?
I'm certain.
So? You've got guns in your room? I say he's dangerous. It's open season on Martians. Pick a gun, go down to the pool and kill him. Don't worry about the law. I guarantee you'll never be indicted. Go ahead, do it.
Jubal, you don't mean that?
No, not really.
Because you can't.
If you tried, your gun would go where my pistol went, and if you hurried him, you'd go with it. Duke, you don't know what you're fiddling with. Mike is not gentle as a lamb, and he is not a savage. I suspect we are savages. Ever raised snakes?
No.
I did when I was a kid. One winter down in Florida, I caught what I thought was a scarlet snake. Know what they look like?
I don't like snakes.
Prejudice again. Most snakes are harmless, useful, and fun to raise. The scarlet snake is a beauty. Red, black, and yellow, docile, and makes a fine pet. I think this little fellow was fond of me. I knew how to handle snakes, how not to alarm them and not give them a chance to bite. Even the bite of a non-poisonous snake is a nuisance. This baby was my prize. I used to take him out and show him to people, holding him back of his head and letting him wrap himself around my wrist. I got a chance to show my collection to the herpetologist of the Tampa Zoo. I showed him my prize first. He almost had hysterics. My pet was not a scarlet snake, it was a young coral snake, the most deadly snake in North America. Duke, do you see my point?
That raising snakes is dangerous, I could have told you.
Oh, for Pete's sake. I had rattlesnakes and water moccasins, too. A poisonous snake is not dangerous, no more than a loaded gun is dangerous. In each case, you must handle it properly. The thing that made that snake dangerous was that I hadn't known what it could do. If in my ignorance I'd handled it carelessly, it would have killed me as casually and innocently as a kitten scratches. That's what I'm trying to tell you about Mike. He seems like an ordinary young male human, rather underdeveloped, clumsy, abysmally ignorant, but bright and docile and eager to learn. But like my snake, Mike is more than he appears to be. If Mike does not trust you, he can be much more deadly than that coral snake. Especially if he thinks you are harming one of his water brothers, such as Jill, or me.
Harshaw shook his head.
Duke, if you had given way to your impulse to take a poke at me, and if Mike had been standing in that doorway, you would have been dead before you knew it, much too quickly for me to stop him. Mike would then have been apologetic over having wasted food, namely your beefy carcass, but he wouldn't feel guilty about killing you. That would be a necessity you forced on him, and not important even to you. You see, Mike believes that your soul is immortal.
Huh?
Well, hell, so do I. But do you? Jubal said bleakly.
I wonder.
Why, certainly I do. Oh, I don't go to church much, but I was brought up right. I've got faith.
Good. Though I've never understood how God could expect his creatures to pick the one true religion by faith, it strikes me as a sloppy way to run a universe. However, since you believe in immortality, we need not trouble over the probability that your prejudices will cause your demise. Do you want to be cremated or buried?
Oh, for cripe's sake, Jubal, quit trying to get my goat.
Not at all. I can't guarantee your safety since you persist in thinking that a coral snake is a harmless scarlet snake. Any blunder may be your last. But I promise I won't let Mike eat you.
Duke's chin dropped. Then he answered, explosively, profanely, incoherently. Harshaw listened, then said testily,
All right, pipe down.
Make any arrangements with Mike you like.
Harshaw bent over the projector.
I want to see these pictures. Damn, he added. The pesky thing savaged me. You tried to force it. Here.
Duke completed the adjustment Harshaw had muffed, then inserted a spool. Neither reopened the question of whether Duke was or was not working for Jubal. The projector was a tabletop tank with adapter to receive solid, sight-sound 4mm film. Shortly, they were watching events leading up to the disappearance of the empty brandy case. Jubal saw the box hurtle toward his head, saw it wink out in midair.
And we'll be pleased to know that the cameras back her up.
Duke, let's repeat that in slow motion.
Okay.
Duke spooled back, then announced,
This is 10-1.
The scene was the same, but slowed down sound was useless. Duke switched it off. The box floated from Jill's hands toward Jubal's head, then ceased to be. But under slow motion, it could be seen shrinking, smaller and smaller until it was no longer there.
Duke, can you slow it still more?
Just a sec. Something has fouled the stereo.
What?
Darned if I know. It looked all right on the fast run. But when I slowed it, the depth effect was reversed. That box went away from us, mighty fast, but it always looked closer than the wall. Swapped parallax, of course, but I never took that cartridge off the spindle.
Oh. Hold it, Duke. Run the film from the other camera.
Ah, I see. That'll give us a 90-degree cross, and we'll see properly, even if I did jimmy this film.
Duke changed cartridges.
Sip through the first part, then undercranked on the last part?
Go ahead.
The scene was unchanged, save for angle. When the image of Jill grabbed the box, Duke slowed action, and again they watched the box go away.
Duke cursed. Something fouled the second camera, too.
So?
It was shooting from the side, so the box should have gone out of frame to one side instead. It went straight away from us again. You saw it?
Yes,
agreed Jubal.
Straight away from us.
But it can't. Not from both angles.
What do you mean, it can't? It did.
Harshaw added. If we had used Doppler radar in place of cameras, I wonder what it would have shown.
How should I know? I'm going to take these cameras apart.
Don't bother.
But,
Duke, the cameras are okay. What is 90 degrees from everything else?
I'm no good at riddles.
It's not a riddle. I could refer you to Mr. A. Square from Flatland, but I'll answer it. What is perpendicular to everything else?
Answer.
Two bodies, one pistol, and an empty case.
What the deuce do you mean, boss?
I never spoke more plainly in my life. Try believing the evidence instead of insisting that the cameras must be at fault because what they saw was not what you expected. Let's see the other films.
They added nothing to what Harshaw already knew. The ashtray when near the ceiling had been out of camera, but its leisurely descent had been recorded. The pistol's image in the tank was small, but so far as could be seen, the pistol had shrunk away into the distance without moving. Since Harshaw had been gripping it tightly when it had left his hand, he was satisfied. If satisfied was the word.
Duke, I want duplicate prints of all those.
Duke hesitated.
I'm still working here?
What? Oh, damn it. You can't eat in the kitchen. That's flat. Duke, try to forget your prejudices and listen.
I'll listen.
When Mike asked for the privilege of eating my stringy old carcass, he was doing me the greatest honor he knows of, by the only rules he knows, what he learned at his mother's knee, so to speak. He was paying me his highest compliment and asking a boon. Never mind what they think in Kansas. Mike uses values taught him on Mars. I'll take Kansas.
Well, admitted Jubal.
So will I, but it is not free choice for me, nor you, nor Mike. It is almost impossible to shake off one's earliest training. Duke, can you get it through your skull that if you had been brought up by Martians, you would have the same attitude toward eating and being eaten that Mike has?
Duke shook his head.
I won't buy it, Jubal. Sure about most things, it's just Mike's hard luck that he wasn't brought up civilized, but this is different. This is an instinct.
Instinct? Dreck.
But it is. I didn't get training at my mother's knee not to be a cannibal. Hell, I've always known it was a sin, a nasty one. But the thought turns my stomach. It's basic instinct.
Jubal groaned.
Duke, how could you learn so much about machinery and never learn anything about how you yourself tick? Your mother didn't have to say, mustn't eat your playmates, dear, that's not nice, because you soaked it up from our culture, and so did I. Jokes about cannibals and missionaries, cartoons, fairy tales, horror stories, endless things. Shuck, son, it couldn't be instinct. Cannibalism is historically a most widespread custom in every branch of the human race. Your ancestors, my ancestors, everybody.
Your ancestors, maybe.
Duke, didn't you tell me you had some Indian blood?
Huh? Yeah, an eighth. What of it?
Then, while both of us have cannibals in our family trees, chances are that yours are many generations closer. Because, why, you bald-headed old...
Simmer down.
Ritual cannibalism was common among Aboriginal American cultures. Look it up. Besides that, as North Americans, we stand a better than even chance of having a touch of Congo without knowing it. And there you are again. But even if we were Simon pure North European stock, a silly notion, casual bastardy is far in excess of that ever admitted, but if we were, such ancestry would merely tell us which cannibals we are descended from, because every branch of the human race has cannibalism. Duke, it's silly to talk about a practice being against instinct when hundreds of millions have followed it.
But... all right, I should know better than to argue with you, Jubal. You twist things.
But suppose we did come from savages who didn't know any better. What of it? We're civilized now, or at least I am.
Jubal grinned, implying that I am not.
Son, aside from my own conditioned reflex against munching a roast haunch of... well, you, for example, aside from that trained-in prejudice, I regard our taboo against cannibalism as an excellent idea. Because we are not civilized.
Huh?
If we didn't have a taboo so strong that you believed it was instinct, I can think of a long list of people I wouldn't trust with my back turned, not with the price of beef what it is today, eh?
Duke grudged a grin.
I wouldn't take a chance on my ex-mother-in-law. Or how about our charming neighbor on the south who was so casual about other people's livestock during hunting season? Want to bet that you and I wouldn't wind up in his freezer? But Mike I trust. Because Mike... is civilized.
Huh?
Mike is utterly civilized. Martian style.
Duke, I've talked enough with Mike to know that Martian practice isn't dog-eat-dog or Martian-eat-Martian. They eat their dead instead of burying them or burning them or exposing them to vultures. But the custom is formalized and deeply religious. A Martian is never butchered against his will. In fact, murder doesn't seem to be a Martian concept.
A Martian dies when he decides to, having discussed it with friends and received consent of his ancestors' ghosts to join them. Having decided to die, he does so, as easily as you close your eyes. No violence, no illness, not even an overdose of sleeping pills. One second he is alive and, well, the next second he's a ghost. Then his friends eat what he no longer has any use for, grocking him, as Mike would say, and praising his virtues as they spread the mustard. The ghost attends the feast. It is a bar mitzvah or confirmation service by which the ghost attains the status of old one. an elder statesman, as I understand it.
Duke made a face.
God, what superstitious junk!
To Mike, it's a solemn, but joyful religious ceremony.
Duke snorted.
Jubal, you don't believe that stuff about ghosts. It's just cannibalism combined with rank superstition.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I find these old ones hard to swallow, but Mike speaks of them the way we talk about last Wednesday. As for the rest, Duke, what church were you brought up in?
Duke told him.
Jubal went on.
I thought so. In Kansas, most people belong to yours, or to one enough like it that you have to look at the sign to tell the difference. Tell me, how did you feel when you took part in the symbolic cannibalism that plays so paramount a part in your church's rituals?
Duke stared.
What the devil do you mean?
Jubal blinked solemnly back.
Were you a member, or simply went to Sunday school?
Huh? Well, certainly I was a member. I still am, though I don't go much.
I thought perhaps you weren't entitled to receive it. Well, you know what I'm talking about if you stop to think.
Jubal stood up.
I shan't argue differences between one form of ritual cannibalism and another. Duke, I can't spend more time trying to shake you loose from prejudice. Are you leaving? If you are, I'd better escort you off the place. Or do you want to stay? Stay and eat with the rest of us cannibals.
Duke frowned. Reckon I'll stay.
I'll wash my hands of it. You saw those movies. If you're bright enough to pound sand, you figured out that this man Martian can be dangerous.
Duke nodded.
I'm not as stupid as you think, Jubal. But I won't let Mike run me off the place, he added. You say he's dangerous, but I'm not going to stir him up. Shucks, Jubal, I like the little dope most ways.
Damn it, you still underestimate him, Duke.
See here, if you feel friendly toward him, the best thing you can do is to offer him a glass of water. Understand me? Become his water brother.
I'll think about it.
But Duke, don't fake it. If Mike accepts your offer, he'll be dead serious. He'll trust you utterly, so don't do it unless you are willing to trust him and stand by him no matter how rough things get. Either all out, or don't do it.
I understood that. That's why I said I'll think about it.
Okay. Don't take too long making up your mind. I expect things to get very rough soon.
Chapter 14. In Laputa, according to Lemuel Gulliver, no person of importance listened or spoke without help of a climinole, or flapper in English translation, as such servant's duty was to flap the mouth and ears of his master with a bladder whenever, in the opinion of the servant, it was desirable for his master to speak or listen. Without the consent of his flapper, it was impossible to converse with any Laputian of the master class. The flapper system was unknown on Mars. Martian old ones would have as little use for flappers as a snake has for shoes. Martians, still corporate, could have used flappers, but did not. The concept ran contrary to their way of living. A Martian needing a few minutes or years of contemplation simply took it. If a friend wished to speak with him, the friend would wait. With eternity to draw on, there could be no reason for hurrying. Hurry was not a concept in Martian. Speed, velocity, simultaneity, acceleration, and other abstractions of the pattern of eternity were part of Martian mathematics, but not of Martian emotion. Contrariwise, the unceasing rush of human existence came not from mathematical necessities of time, but from the frantic urgency implicit in human sexual bipolarity. On the planet Terra, the flapper system developed slowly. Time was when any Terran sovereign held public court, so that the lowliest might come before him without intermediary. Traces of this persisted long after kings became scarce. An Englishman could cry herald, although none did, and the smarter city bosses still left their doors open to any Gandhi dancer or bindle stiff far into the 20th century. A remnant of the principle was embalmed in Amendments 1 and 9 of the United States Constitution, although superseded by the Articles of World Federation. By the time the champion returned from Mars, the principle of access to the sovereign was dead, in fact, regardless of the nominal form of government, and the importance of a personage could be told by the layers of flappers cutting him off from the mob. They were known as executive assistants, private secretaries, secretaries to private secretaries, press secretaries, receptionists, appointment clerks, etc. But all were flappers, as each held arbitrary veto over communication from the outside. These webs of officials resulted in unofficials who flapped the great man without permission from official flappers, using social occasions or backdoor access or unlisted telephone numbers. These unofficials were called golfing companion, kitchen cabinet, lobbyist, elder statesman, five percenter, and so forth. The unofficials grew webs, too, until they were almost as hard to reach as the great man, and secondary unofficials sprang up to circumvent the flappers of primary unofficials. With a personage of foremost importance, the maze of unofficials was as complex as the official phalanxes surrounding a person merely very important. Dr. Jubal Harshaw, professional clown, amateur subversive, and parasite by choice, had an almost Martian attitude toward hurry. Being aware that he had but a short time to live, and having neither Martian nor Kansan faith in immortality, he purposed to live each golden moment as eternity, without fear, without hope, with sybaritic gusto. To this end, he required something larger than Diogenes' tub, but smaller than Kubla's pleasure dome. His was a simple place, a few acres kept private with electrified fence, a house of 14 rooms or so with running secretaries and other modern conveniences. To support his austere nest and rabble staff, he put forth minimum effort for maximum return, because it was easier to be rich than poor. Harshaw wished to live in lazy luxury, doing what amused Harshaw. He felt aggrieved when circumstances forced on him a necessity for hurry, and would never admit that he was enjoying himself. This morning, he needed to speak to the planet's chief executive. He knew that the flapper system made such contact all but impossible. Harshaw disdained to surround himself with flappers suitable to his own rank. He answered his telephone himself if he happened to be at hand, because each call offered odds that he could be rude to some stranger for daring to invade his privacy without cause. Cause, by Harshaw's definition. He knew that he would not find such conditions at the Executive Palace. Mr. Secretary General would not answer his own phone. But Harshaw had years of practice in outwitting human customs. He tackled the matter cheerfully, after breakfast. His name carried him slowly through several layers of flappers. He was sufficiently a narrow-gauge VIP that he was never switched off. He was referred from secretary to secretary, and wound up speaking to an urbane young man who seemed willing to listen endlessly, no matter what Harshaw said, but would not connect him with the Honorable Mr. Douglas. Harshaw knew that he would get action if he claimed to have the man from Mars with him, but he did not think that the result would suit him. He calculated that mention of Smith would kill any chance of reaching Douglas, while producing reaction from subordinates, which he did not want. With Caxton's life at stake, Harshaw could not risk failure through a subordinate's lack of authority or excess of ambition. But this soft brush-off tried his patience. Finally, he snarled, "Young man, if you have no authority, let me speak to someone who has. Put me through to Mr. Berquist." The stooge suddenly lost his smile, and Jubal thought gleefully that he had at last pinked him. So he pushed on.
"Well, don't just sit there. Get Gill on your inside line and tell him you've kept Jubal Harshaw waiting."
The face said woodenly, "We have no Mr. Berquist here."
"I don't care where he is, get him. If you don't know Gil Berquist, ask your boss. Mr. Gilbert Berquist, personal assistant to Mr. Douglas. If you work around the palace, you've seen Mr. Berquist. 35, 6 feet and 180 pounds, sandy hair, thin on top, smiles a lot and has perfect teeth. If you don't dare disturb him, dump it in your boss's lap. Quit biting your nails and move."
The young man said, "Please hold on. I will inquire."
"I certainly will. Get me Gil."
The image was replaced by an abstract pattern. A voice said, "Please wait while your call is completed. This delay is not charged to your account. Please relax while..." Soothing music came up. Jubal sat back and looked around. Anne was reading, out of the telephone's vision angle. On his other side, the man from Mars was also out of pickup and was watching stereovision and listening via earplugs. Jubal reflected that he must have that obscene babble box returned to the basement.
"What you got, son?" he asked,
reached over and turned on the speaker. Mike answered,
"I don't know, Jubal."
The sound confirmed what Jubal had feared. Smith was listening to a Fosterite service. The shepherd was reading church notices.
Junior Spirit in Action team will give a demonstration, so come early and see the fur fly. Our team coach, Brother Hornsby, has asked me to tell you boys to fetch only your helmets, gloves, and sticks. We aren't going after sinners this time. However, the little cherubim will be on hand with their first aid kits in case of excessive zeal.
The shepherd paused and smiled broadly.
And now wonderful news, my children. A message from Angel Ramsay for Brother Arthur Renwick and his good wife Dorothy. Your prayer has been approved, and you will go to heaven at dawn Thursday morning. Stand up, Art. Stand up, Dottie. Take a bow.
Camera made reverse cut, showing the congregation and centering on Brother and Sister Renwick. To wild applause and shouts of Hallelujah, Brother Renwick was responding with a boxer's handshake, while his wife blushed and smiled and dabbed at her eyes beside him. Camera cut back as the shepherd held up his hand for silence. He went on briskly.
The bon voyage party starts at midnight and doors will be locked at that time. So get here early, and let's make this the happiest revelry our flock has ever seen. We're all proud of Art and Dottie. Funeral services will be held 30 minutes after dawn, with breakfast immediately following for those who have to get to work early.
The shepherd suddenly looked stern, and camera zoomed in until his head filled the tank.
After our last bon voyage, the sexton found an empty pint bottle in one of the happiness rooms, of a brand distilled by sinners.
As past and done, the brother who slipped confessed and paid penance sevenfold, even refusing the usual cash discount.
I'm sure he won't backslide. But stop and think, my children. Is it worth risking eternal happiness to save a few pennies on an article of worldly merchandise? Always look for that happy, holy seal of approval with Bishop Digby's smiling face on it. Don't let a sinner palm off on you something just as good. Our sponsors support us. They deserve your support. Brother Art, I'm sorry to have to bring up such a subject.
That's okay, Shepherd. Pour it on.
At a time of such great happiness. But we must never forget that...
Jubal switched off the speaker circuit.
Mike, that's not anything you need.
Not?
Shucks, the boy's gonna have to learn about such things.
All right, go ahead. But talk to me later.
Yes, Jubal.
Harsha was about to add advice to offset Mike's tendency to take literally anything he heard. But the telephone's hold music went down and out, and the screen filled with an image, a man in his 40s whom Jubal labeled as Cop.
Jubal said aggressively,
"You aren't Gil Berquist?"
"What is your interest in Gilbert Berquist?"
Jubal answered with pained patience,
"I wish to speak to him."
"See here, my good man, are you a public employee?"
The man hesitated.
"Yes. I must nothing. I'm a citizen and my taxes help pay your wages. All morning I've been trying to make a simple phone call and I've been passed from one butterfly brain bovine to another, every one of them feeding out of the public trough. And now, you. Give me your name, job title, and pay number, then I'll speak to Mr. Berquist."
"You didn't answer my question."
"Come, come, I don't have to. I'm a private citizen. You are not, and the question I asked, any citizen may demand of any public servant, O'Kelly versus State of California, 1972. I demand that you identify yourself, name, job, number."
The man answered tonelessly. "You are Dr. Jubal Harshaw. You are calling from..."
"So that's what took so long?"
"That was stupid. My address can be obtained from any library, post office, or telephone information. As to who I am, everyone knows. Everyone who can read. Can you read?"
"Dr. Harshaw, I am a police officer, and I require your cooperation."
"What is your reason?"
"Pooh, sir, I'm a lawyer.
A citizen is required to cooperate with police under certain conditions only. For example, during hot pursuit, in which case the police officer may still be required to show credentials. Is this hot pursuit, sir? Are you about to dive through this blasted instrument? Second, a citizen may be required to cooperate within reasonable and lawful limits in the course of police investigation."
"This is an investigation."
"Of what, sir?"
"Before you may require my cooperation, you must identify yourself, satisfy me as to your bona fides, state your purpose, and if I so require, cite the code and show that reasonable necessity exists. You have done none of these. I wish to speak to Mr. Berquist."
The man's jaw muscles were jumping, but he answered,
"I'm Captain Heinrich of the Federation SS Bureau. The fact that you reached me by calling the Executive Palace should be proof that I am who I say I am. However..."
He took out a wallet, flipped it open, and held it to his pickup. Harshaw glanced at the ID.
"Very well, Captain," he growled. "Will you now explain why you are keeping me from speaking with Mr. Berquist?"
"Mr. Berquist is not available."
"Then why didn't you say so? Transfer my call to someone of Berquist's rank. I mean one of the people who work directly with the Secretary General, as Gil does. I don't propose to be fobbed off on some junior assistant flunky with no authority to blow his own nose. If Gil isn't there, then for God's sake get me someone of equal rank."
"You've been trying to telephone the Secretary General."
"Precisely."
"Very well. You may explain what business you have with the Secretary General."
"And I may not." "Are you a confidential assistant to the Secretary General? Are you privy to his secrets?"
"That's beside the point."
"That's exactly the point. As a police officer, you know better. I shall explain to some person known to me to be cleared for sensitive material and in Mr. Douglas's confidence, just enough to make sure that the Secretary General speaks to me." "Are you sure Mr. Berquist can't be reached?"
"Quite sure."
"Then it will have to be someone else of his rank."
"If it's that secret, you shouldn't be calling over a phone."
"My good Captain, since you had this call traced, you know that my phone is equipped to receive a maximum security return call."
The SS officer ignored this. Instead, he answered, "Doctor, I'll be blunt. Until you explain your business, you aren't going to get anywhere. If you call again, your call will be routed to this office. Call 100 times or a month from now. Same thing. Until you cooperate."
Jubal smiled happily.
"It won't be necessary now, as you have let slip. Unwittingly, or was it intentional? The one datum needed before we act, if we must. I can hold them off the rest of the day. But the code word is no longer Berquist."
"What the devil do you mean?"
"My dear Captain, please, not over an unscrambled circuit. But you know, or should know, that I am a senior philosophunculist on active duty."
"Repeat?"
"Haven't you studied amphigory? Gad, what they teach in schools these days. Back to your pinochle game, I don't need you."
Jubal switched off, set the phone for 10 minutes refusal, said,
"Come along, kids,"
and returned to his loafing spot near the pool. He cautioned Anne to keep her witness robe at hand, told Mike to stay in earshot, and gave Miriam instructions concerning the telephone. Then he relaxed. He was not displeased. He had not expected to reach the Secretary General at once. His reconnaissance had uncovered one weak spot in the wall surrounding the Secretary, and he expected that his bout with Captain Heinrich would bring a return call from a higher level. If not, the exchange of compliments with the SS cop had been rewarding in itself, and had left him in a warm glow. Harshaw held that certain feet were made for stepping on, in order to improve the breed, promote the general welfare, and minimize the ancient insolence of office. He had seen at once that Heinrich had such feet. But he wondered how long he could wait. In addition to the pending collapse of his bomb, and the fact that he had promised Jill to take steps on behalf of Caxton, something new was crowding him. Duke was gone. Gone for the day, gone for good or for bad, Jubal did not know. Duke had been at dinner, had not shown up for breakfast. Neither was noteworthy in Harshaw's household, and no one else seemed to miss Duke. Jubal looked across the pool, watched Mike attempt to perform a dive exactly as Dorcas had just performed it, and admitted to himself that he had not asked about Duke this morning on purpose. The truth was that he did not want to ask the bear what had happened to Algy. The bear might answer. Well, there was only one way to cope with weakness.
"Mike, come here."
"Yes, Jubal." The man from Mars got out of the pool and trotted over like an eager puppy. Harshaw looked him over, decided that he must weigh 20 pounds more than he had on arrival, all of it muscle.
"Mike, do you know where Duke is?"
"No, Jubal."
"Well, that settled it. The boy didn't know how to lie."
"Wait, hold it." Jubal remembered Mike's computer-like habit of answering only the question asked, and Mike had not appeared to know where that pesky box was once it was gone.
"Mike, when did you see him last?"
"I saw Duke go upstairs when Jill and I came downstairs this morning when time to cook breakfast." Mike added proudly, "I helped cooking."
"That was the last time you saw Duke?"
"I am not see Duke since, Jubal. I proudly burned toast."
"I'll bet you did. You'll make some woman a fine husband if you aren't careful."
"Oh, I burned it most carefully."
Jubal?
Huh? Yes, Anne.
Duke grabbed an early breakfast and lit out for town. I thought you knew.
Well, Jubal temporized. I thought he intended to leave after lunch.
Jubal suddenly felt a load lifted.
Not that Duke meant anything to him, of course not. For years he had avoided letting any human being be important to him. But it would have troubled him. A little, anyhow.
What statute was violated in turning a man 90 degrees from everything else? Not murder, as long as the lad used it only in self-defense, or in the proper defense of another, such as Jill. Pennsylvania laws against witchcraft might apply, but it would be interesting to see how an indictment would be worded. A civil action might lie. Could harboring the man from Mars be construed as maintaining an attractive nuisance? It was likely that new rules of law must evolve. Mike had already kicked the bottom out of medicine and physics, even though the practitioners of such were aware of the chaos. Harshaw recalled the tragedy that relativity had been for many scientists. Unable to digest it, they had taken refuge in anger at Einstein. Their refuge had been a dead end. All that inflexible old guard could do was die and let younger minds take over. His grandfather had told him of the same thing in medicine when germ theory came along. Physicians had gone to their graves calling Pasteur a liar, a fool, or worse, without examining evidence which their common sense told them was impossible. Well, he could see that Mike was going to cause more hurrah than Pasteur and Einstein combined. Which reminded him.
Larry, where's Larry?
Here, boss, the loudspeaker behind him announced. Down in the shop.
Got the panic button?
Sure. You said to sleep with it. I do.
Bounce up here and give it to Anne. And keep it with your robe.
She nodded. Larry answered, right away, boss. Countdown coming up?
Just do it.
Jubal found that the man from Mars was still in front of him, quiet as a sculptured figure.
Sculpture?
Jubal searched his memory. Michelangelo's David. Yes, even the puppyish hands and feet, the serenely sensual face, the tousled, too long hair.
That was all, Mike.
Yes, Jubal.
But Mike waited. Jubal said,
something on your mind, son.
About what I was seeing in that goddamn noisy box. You said, but talk to me later.
Oh.
Harshaw recalled the Fosterite broadcast and winced.
Yes, but don't call that thing a goddamn noisy box. It is a stereo vision receiver.
Mike looked puzzled.
Is it not a goddamn noisy box? I heard you not rightly.
It is indeed a goddamn noisy box, but you must call it a stereo vision receiver.
I will call it a stereo vision receiver. Why, Jubal? I do not grok.
Harshaw sighed. He had climbed these stairs too many times. Any conversation with Smith turned up human behavior which could not be justified logically, and attempts to do so were endlessly time-consuming.
I do not grok it myself, Mike, he admitted, but Jill wants you to say it that way.
I will do it, Jubal. Jill wants it.
Now tell me what you saw and heard, and what you grok of it.
Mike recalled every word and action in the babble tank, including all commercials. Since he had almost finished the encyclopedia, he had read articles on religion, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Confucianism, Buddhism, and related subjects. He had grokked none of this. Jubal learned that A. Mike did not know that the Fosterite service was religious. B. Mike remembered what he had read about religions, but had filed such for future meditation, not having understood them. C. Mike had a most confused notion of what religion meant, although he could quote 9 dictionary definitions. D. The Martian language contained no word which Mike could equate with any of these definitions. E. The customs which Jubal had described to Duke as Martian religious ceremonies were not. To Mike, such matters were as matter-of-fact as grocery markets were to Jubal. F. It was not possible to separate in the Martian tongue the human concepts religion, philosophy, and science. And since Mike thought in Martian, it was not possible for him to tell them apart. All such matters were learnings from the old ones. Doubt he had never heard of, nor of research, no Martian word for either. The answers to any questions were available from the old ones, who were omniscient and infallible, whether on tomorrow's weather or cosmic teleology. Mike had seen a weather forecast and had assumed that this was a message from human old ones for those still corporate. He held a similar assumption concerning the authors of the Encyclopedia Britannica.